Welcome to the Power of the Purse podcast, the only show connecting women professionals to their peers. Join us in a vibrant conversation about the constant struggle to find balance between the demands of their careers and their relationships with money, family, and personal freedom. This isn't just about money. This is about life. Now, here's your host, Lynn S. Evans.
And I am the host of Power of the Purse podcast. We should know that personal finance isn't about being rich or getting rich quick. It's about buying independence and freedom of choice. You are not alone as you struggle with being the perfect wife, mother, daughter, daughter-in-law, and all the other traditional roles assigned to us by our culture. These pressures can feel overwhelming. And when we add the demands of a career on top of it all, many women choose to pass on dealing with money issues until they're forced to. And that's not the best time to learn. Here we explore the stories of women and how they've handled the demands of finance, family, and career. We talk about falling short of perfection, but also about the lessons we've learned and the best advice our peers have to offer for financial security and putting our perceived failures in their proper place. My mission is to help women have a healthy, positive relationship with money. With that in mind, my guest today is Lee Carraher. She started Double Forte in 2002 as a new kind of communications firm designed to provide the best service in the business. Previously Executive Vice President at Weber Shandwick, President and founder of Red Whistle, and Vice President, and I think that's the youngest Vice President, of SIGA. Lee has managed multiple offices and hundreds of people of all ages and was named in the 40 Under 40 by PR Week magazine. She holds a bachelor's degree in medieval history, which she finds useful every day. She lives with her husband and two sons on the San Francisco Peninsula. She's also the author of a book, Millennials and Management, The Essential Guide to Making It Work at Work. Welcome, Lee.
Lynn, thanks you so much. It's so great to be with you.
I can't wait to get into this because I have so many questions I wanted to ask you.
Okay.
Because I've done some homework and I find it very intriguing. Yeah, that's a good thing. But let's start first with this thing about your degree in medieval history.
Yeah.
How did you even find that as a degree?
I went to Carleton College in Minnesota, which is an awesome institution, and I actually went in as a pre-med. And my father is a retired surgeon, and I had worked for him during the summer, et cetera. And it really interested me. And I went into school as a pre-med, and I realized very quickly that I hated all of the classes I was going to have to take for the next 8 years. I'm like, ugh, I just dreaded going to the lab. I hated it. I was good at it, but I just didn't like it. But what really turned me on was my history class. In my first history class, Carleton has a trimester system, so you only take three classes at a time. And my first history class at school, at college, was Chaucer's England. And I had a professor, Phil Niles, who is just an amazing deconstructionist. And I learned in my first paper that we all failed, all 18 of us failed, that Rome did not fall. So that really just got me going. And I decided that I should spend time where I'm happiest and not dread what I'm going to have to spend my time with.
That's for sure.
So that's how I ended up being a history major. And medieval history was what really just intrigued me the most. I didn't tell my parents I had decided this until after I declared my major at the end of sophomore year. And I sort of called home. I was like, oh, gosh, Dad, I declared my major today. It's history. And he goes, thank God. I didn't want you to be a doctor like me. I was like, you could have told me that before.
Did he really?
Yeah, well, he was very prolific in his field, but he really didn't start living until he was 45. And he saved a lot of lives until he was 45, and he saved a lot of lives after that. But, you know, he's like, you know, being a doctor is not just, I mean, it's such an admirable
profession, but it is not a lifestyle that my father would have chosen for me, particularly with the financial risks involved.
Well, that's good that he took it that well.
So well, my God, if he'd only told me. Sheesh. I would have, like, slept a lot better for a year.
I'll bet you would have. Yeah. You wouldn't have dreaded going home for Thanksgiving and things like that, too.
So funny.
How did you get from the medieval history thing into a PR firm? How did that happen?
Carleton is a traditional liberal arts college. You know, you sort of roll out of there. You're so well-rounded. And I didn't, my minor was performance music as a singer. And what I knew was that I didn't want to, and the music department said I should, really wanted me to go pursue music, and the history department wanted me to go pursue history. And what I knew about myself was that I was not great at just focusing on one thing, it was not my strength. My friend Ramona said, we were, you know, basically I was like, I don't know what the heck I'm going to do with my life. She goes, I think you should look into PR. And I said, what is PR? And she told me, and I went over to the Career Center, and I was like, there was a book, What is PR? Right next to the What is Advertising book. And I was like, all right. And I looked at it, and I'm like, that sounds like me. So,
are you serious? There really is a book called What is PR?
I don't know if it exists anymore, but it did that many decades ago. It did exist then, and I read it, and I was like, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, that feels like me. So Carleton's in Minnesota. I decided, I looked into, I researched everything. Where should I go to pursue this career? Decided on Boston. I reached out to my father's best friend, who is since deceased, but at the time, you know, was a business lawyer in Boston, very well known. I asked for his help. He made me write a letter to him saying why he should help me. I failed at that letter. He made me rewrite it. I rewrote it, and then he said he would help me. And then he called in a lot of chits, and I had I went to visit for a week. He got me 11 informational interviews in a week. Out of that, I got 4 offers. I took the one that paid the most, and that was in high-tech PR in Boston in 1987. So that's how I got in, and I've never gotten out.
Now, is this the same guy you mentioned as a mentor, Chip?
Chip, yeah, Chip Morse.
Yeah, yeah.
Huge mentor of mine.
That's wonderful that you had a mentor that early in your life who put you on the right track.
Mm-hmm. And I have given, because of him, I have given every informational interview or provided some way to have, that has ever been asked of me. Because I would not have a career if people hadn't helped him help me.
You mentioned another woman named, is it Mary Jane?
Mary Jane.
The great mentor of yours?
Great mentor of mine. I worked with her twice, and every time
every time the going gets tough, I sort of channel my Mary Jane. I get very still, and I tilt my head to the right, and I say, tell me more. Well, I buy myself time so I don't either get angry or I can understand better. So she's an amazing, amazing influence on my career.
Good. I noticed also that you did an interview with someone else where you said you started your company by sitting in your garage with your friend.
I did.
How'd that happen?
So after 9/11 in 2001, I decided I wasn't very enthralled with my job, and I had been on the United flight from New York to San Francisco the week before. And
wow.
I really didn't want to do that anymore. We really brought it home. I'm the breadwinner in my family. My husband works just part-time, but for very little money. He's a social worker now, helping families like ours. I have our younger son has special needs. At the time, 9/11, I had 2 young children. I was a 100,000-mile flyer by July. It was just not fun. 9/11 happened. It could have been me. And I said, I'm not doing this anymore. So I decided to take a chunk of time off. I exercised my contract, which was very favorable. Mm-hmm. And I was going to go not work for a PR firm. My mother ended up getting diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer in April of 2002. And at that time, I was heavy in the hunt for 2 pretty big jobs, but my parents lived in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and I decided I was going to be with my mom, and so I pulled myself out of those 2 job hunts, and we just decided I was going to be with my mother until the end, and because I would not have been able to keep those jobs and take care of my mother at the same time. And at that moment, I was like, well, I guess I have to start my own firm because that'll let me be where I need to be for both my company and my family. My mother ended up living for four years, which was wonderful. But I started my company, Double 4K, with my friend Dan after my mom had been diagnosed and we were trying to figure out what to do. And while we were figuring it out, we worked out of my garage and we quickly figured out that was not a recipe for success. So,
hey, it worked for a lot of guys in Silicon Valley.
Here's the thing about a garage, though. You don't stay in the garage. You start in a garage.
Okay, big difference.
Big difference. So we started in a garage. We figured out what we were going to do. We figured out what was good about working from home and what was not good about working from home for us. And we both decided we were not good at it. And so then we got a great address and a crappy office in Ghirardelli Square. So we would look bigger than we were. And that was how we got off the ground.
That's good. So how did you start your business? Did you just go back to some of the people you worked with and say, hey, I'm me, I got a new business?
Pretty much. I had already had a pretty successful career. I'd worked at Sega of America, the video game company, for 5 years, had a great network there. I'd worked at Interpublic, Weber Shandwick, like you said, where I started a firm called Red Whistle under the Weber Shandwick brand. Had a great network there. And Dan, my partner, had worked with me both at Sega and at Red Whistle, Weber Shandwick. So we had really strong networks of people who trusted us. And even when I wasn't working, we were both in high demand as consultants. So when we put together our business plan, our proposition, what we wanted to focus on, how we wanted to work, we actually made three lists. Our first list was the people who we would work with no matter what. Who would we work with again, no matter what they were doing? Because they were great people. We trusted them. They liked us. We get a lot done. We had fun. We made a list of the people we never wanted to work with ever again for the opposite reasons, which was actually a longer list than the first list. And then we made a list of everybody in between, people who would be great to work with if it was the right situation I would work with so-and-so if he was well-supported. Don't work with this guy if he doesn't have any support, that kind of thing. Yeah. And which was the longest list. And in that longest list, we actually tiered it out. You know, we made grade one, grade two, grade three kind of thing. And then we just started working our list. The first list was, I think, of 12 people long. We went and met with each of them individually, telling them what they were going to do. And we actually asked for their help. Did they have anything that they could assign us as a project to earn our stripes, or did they have someone they could introduce us to? And we very much focused on those first 12 and that next 20 when we started the company, and we still do that today. I mean, the list has changed a little bit, but not dramatically in terms of who's on that list and how we work it to make sure that people know who we are. You can't be shy about asking for help when you're starting a business.
No, and I was just going to say exactly. When you said this is the first day we actually considered ourselves a viable business, how long did it take from that day until you got your first check?
Our first check was, that was 37 days.
All right.
Well, what happened?
But who's counting, right?
Who's counting? Well, here's the deal, right? All of our contracts, we require a deposit, or you either have to deposit us against the last 60 days, or you have to pay us ahead 30 to 60 days. So we don't work. It's money in the bank. So that has been... So that's how I know it was 37 days, because we got paid on September 1st and we had done it. We had signed a contract We'd started talking to people in end of July.
Yeah. Anyway. Okay. Well, that's good. That's really incredible that you did that. And I suppose then from there, it just went exponentially and you just kept growing.
I think, our growth wasn't really our goal. Just making something good was our goal. Like being happy in our work was our goal. We had been really not very happy in our last job. The conditions were just very challenging for lots of reasons. And we decided that we would have currency, money is a currency, but we actually had four currencies that we cared about. And so money is a very important currency that the other currencies can't exist without money, right? But the other currencies are, we didn't want to work with jerks. And we didn't want, we wanted to be interested in what we were working on. And we wanted to get home at 6 o'clock on Friday. And the two of us had not been home at 6 o'clock on Friday for over a decade. And when you make those decisions, like how do I get home at 6 o'clock on Friday? Well, that says a lot about what you will and will not work for. Like I will not work for people who don't respect us, who forget everything and then call us at 5 o'clock on Friday and say, I need this by Monday at five. You know, that's not what you should do. Yeah. And you don't work with people who are in crisis work. And that has changed dramatically since we started our company. We didn't actively seek crisis work at the beginning of the agency. But today, about a quarter of our business is crisis because of what has happened with the internet. At that time, it was 2002. The internet didn't have the impact that it does today.
Yeah. You also wrote a lot of information on, and actually a book,
mm-hmm.
on the millennials.
Yes.
And I'm just curious to know what the genesis was of that. Did you find that you were working with millennials? And you said something in an interview about it being such a negative connotation. How did you get involved with that? Were you finding that most of your workforce were millennials?
When we started the company, we only hired people who had 10 years of experience. And by definition, they were probably 32 or older. And the goal was that we didn't have to babysit. Because we had phased out a lot of Gen Xers in 2000, between 99 and 2001. In San Francisco, you know, if you had a pulse, you got a job, and it was just, you know, it wasn't very much fun. In 2002, you couldn't swing a dead cat without hitting, you know, 95 people who needed a job, no matter how many years of experience they had. It was a really good model because we didn't have to do a lot of oversight, a lot of training to get stuff done. So it really changed the dynamic. And I was spending 27 weeks a year for the first 4 years of my business in Wisconsin with my mom and my dad. So in 2008, though, by that time we had 18 people. And I was actually figuring out how to work 4 days a week because I had 18 people and it was great and we were doing so well. And that was September 13th. Well, September 14th, I figured out who was going to do all the work that I was doing. And then September 15th, by 10 o'clock, I was like, oh, my God, I'll be happy if I'm at 4 days. I'll never be at 4 days. I'll be happy if it's 5 days a week. At 11, it was 6 days a week. At noon, it was 8 days a week, you know, because as we were watching the economy just collapse in front of us, that idea of not having to work harder for less, you know, sort of walked out, you know, just became very real. We're going to have to work harder for less. And then at the same time, you know, so we figured out, I mean, I knew what was going to happen to our business. I'd been through this before. So we cut every piece of expense we could out of the company other than salaries. And we changed some things in our attitude, and we did, you know, we have to be the easiest agency to work with, because if you're not easy to work with, people don't pay you in a hard economy.
Well, what did that look like?
Well, I think the first thing was we had to stop saying no, right? The first thing we said, you know, clients can't hear you say no, even when no is the right answer. Yeah. They have to hear you say yes, even when no is the right answer. And it doesn't mean you're actually saying yes. It doesn't mean you're actually doing what they asked. It means that you're listening hard. So you might say, instead of saying, that's a dumb idea, which I'm sure no one actually ever said in my staff, but they may have said, let's do it this way, or no, that's not what we're going to do, because they felt so strongly about it and they were acting on our client's behalf. You can still act on your client's behalf and say yes, which sounds like, that sounds really interesting. Tell me more. And you're sort of buying yourself time to have people talk to you. So they hear you being enthusiastic about their idea. And so that was a dramatic shift in our business from a service perspective that we shifted literally on September 15th or 16th that year. And then
was that sustained then?
Absolutely. Inside the company, we say getting to know through yes, which, you know, outside the company, you can't really say that out loud too many places. But inside the company, everybody knows what it means. And then also the other thing we did in early 2009, after we'd gotten through, you know, just the collapse of the economy, was to take a look at the business model. Because every time your business or your region or the national economy goes through some sort of major shift, you have to look at your, my belief is you have to look at your business model, because the business model that got you to that point is probably not the business model that take you out of that point. And so what we did was say, okay, you know what? This business model of only hiring people with 10 years of experience is not going to be relevant going forward. We were going to run out of people with 10 years of experience pretty soon, because no one had been hired in our business in between 2000 and 2004. So we decided to hire younger people. And I had thought nothing of this, because in my previous two jobs, I'd had literally hundreds of them who wanted to work for me. We hired our first 22 or 23-year-old, and that was a little bumpy. She brought her dog to work in her first day. She left the work at 3 o'clock that day. She didn't come to work the second day. And I was like, what the heck just happened? And I started, and it's sort of like, it was sort of like an anomaly, but because she was fantastic, great ideas, huge work. I mean, just tremendous throughput. And then in early 2010 or 11, I can't remember now, getting the year screwed up, we hired 6 millennials. I'm sorry, late 2010, we hired 6 millennials within 6 or 7 weeks of each other, and they were all gone within 3 months. And I had never had 100% failure in recruiting in my life. And one person could be their fault, but so all of them had to be our fault, my fault. So I started looking at the situation. I didn't know there was such a thing as a millennial. Started talking to people. All of the boomer, my boomer friends, I'm a boomer. I'm the last year of boomer. All my boomer friends, literally to a person, I'm like, oh my God, these terrible millennials. Oh, they're terrible. Oh my God, don't hire them all. I mean, it was just, you know, gnashing of teeth. And then I started doing some research on it. And at that time, in 2011, there was probably a million or two negative entries, negative stories about working with millennials. Today, if you did it, looked at the, if you did a Google search on the topic, you'd probably find 4.5 million negative stories about working with millennials. And I just said to myself, you know, I'm in this. I'm the breadwinner. I'm the owner of the business. By then, my partner had been bought out and he had gone to a much, much larger firm. I gotta, like, not be negative about these people. They're my future. You can't be negative about the future of the future of the business. So I sought out really to make it a positive thing. So I just basically ignored everything negative I'd read. And I started interviewing people and I started talking to our own and, you know, that kind of stuff. Reading. I do a lot of reading. And putting together, you know, sort of a culture that would mean that millennials would succeed. And it was really just for ourselves. It had nothing to do with sharing what we learned. At the same time, people in my client base were having the same sort of issues. And I got to sort of tap, my business became more about that. Like, how can I help them do better with their own millennials? And then I was happened to be talking to a publisher, my current publisher, about something else, and this topic came up, and she just looked at me and she said, I will publish that book. And I was like, what are you talking about? I don't have a book on that topic. She goes, yes, you do. And can you get it done in a few months? I'm like, yes, I can. So I think that doesn't happen very often, and it was a very generous offer from them, and I decided to do that. And I really, you know, my goal with the book was to share what I learned the hard way and through other research and other people who have done it successfully, a positive way of creating intergenerational workplaces.
If you could, like in 3 bullet points or something, what did you learn about how to interact with millennials that most of us baby boomers don't know?
Well, the first piece is millennials want to be listened to and they want to make an impact day one. So how can you adjust yourself to allow them to do that? So that's number one. Just because I said so worked very well for the baby boomers does not work well at all for millennials. So every project needs to start with the why. Like, why are we doing this? What? And what do you? How do you think we could do it better? If you just start every project with here's why we're doing it and how can we do it better, you will be so much better off than if you just sort of barrel your way into doing things. And if you work, you know, and that works for everybody. That has nothing to do. Millennials require it, but it benefits everybody. And the point of my book, despite the title, is that if you create a book, if you create a work environment where millennials can thrive, both Gen Xers and boomers who have their own differences too, will also thrive. But if you do not, you will not keep them, and you will not, you know, a business without a millennial is a business without a future. So, you know, better to shift now than later.
That's Lee the Millennial Whisperer.
I should have whispered that whole thing for you, Lynn. Sorry.
No, I don't think you should have. That wouldn't have been good. You know, most baby boomers have hearing problems. So that would not have been a good move.
That's funny.
Let me switch this around now to ask you some of the questions that I know you sent relative to this Power of the Purse podcast today. So I'm just curious to know your answers to some of these, because I suspect they'll be very revealing about the decisions you made in your life.
Okay.
So let me ask you that first one. What's your first memory around money?
My first memory of money is having to pay my own brownie dues, because my mother was the brownie troop leader. And everybody else's mother gave them the 25 cents every week, because I saw them do it. And my mother made me take it out of my allowance.
Wow. Okay. So you learned a value then for that 25 cents.
Yeah.
Okay. What lessons about money did you learn when you were growing up?
You know, one of the best things my mother did for me was she gave, and when I turned 13, when I have two younger sisters, when we turned 13, she gave us a clothing allowance. And she would allow us to go up to 2 months ahead in our allowance. And I think it was like, you know, this is 30 years ago. So maybe it was like 40 years ago now. Maybe it was $50 a month. So $600 a year, and it had to pay for things, everything except for uniforms and shoes, because my grandmother liked to pay for our shoes.
Oh, that's nice.
And she would allow us to, you couldn't go over 3 months in debt, right? So you had, you could like spend up to 3 months, at 2 months ahead, so your own month plus 2 months, but you couldn't spend any more of that. So for, you know, and then you had to like go back to zero before you could spend some more. And what I learned first was sort of the having to wait, to buy things, and, you know, waiting to buy that Farrell sweater, to, you know, the expensive Farrell sweater that I wanted. And like, do you get underwear or do you get sweaters? And that was hard. And my younger sister, when she got her allowance, she bought 13 coats her first year.
What?
She had to borrow money from me for underwear because my mother would not give her any money for her underwear.
Whatever prompted her
she
to
liked
think
jackets.
She needed 13 coats.
She liked jackets a lot. Oh. The other thing I learned was, you know, you buy cheap, you have to buy a lot. So yeah. I learned to buy better quality as soon as I could afford it. And that was an important lesson that I'm now giving to my older son. I should have done it earlier, but he went to boarding school. It's a long story, but he will have a clothing allowance for the next 4 years while he's in college. And that will be a dramatic shock to him.
Well, I'm sure. And I bet it won't be just $600.
Well, first of all, he's 6'6", so he can't buy anything at the store, but
exactly.
Actually, my husband and I are debating what that number is right now, but we're going to do that for him. And hopefully that will help him, you know, go into the real world with understanding a little more about how to manage your money.
Yeah. What do you think has been the most threatening to your financial security?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'll tell you what's the most threatening thing that, so my younger son was born with, pretty dramatic special needs and health issues. Health issues have cleaned themselves up, but the special needs will never go away. And my whole work reason for being changed dramatically when we really came to understand that our younger son will never be independent. And he is now 15. I will not bore you with all the legalities of having a special needs child who will not be independent, but, everything we do in our house is about making sure that our older son will not be financially responsible for our younger son. And every decision really about where we live, what's my career, what's my end game, how do we spend money today, how do we spend money tomorrow, that is all about that. And, you know, starting my own company was a big risky move
Yeah.
But I was not, again, I was going to take care of my mother. So it was really the only choice.
Was he born at that time?
He had been born. We were just figuring it out. We had figured it out right before 9/11. We had figured out that he was way behind. Mm-hmm. He was born in the end of 2000. And really, by the time he didn't really walk until he was 2.5, didn't talk, didn't say the word, anything but the word blue until he was 8 years old. So until that point, we were dumping a lot of money into his education, into my eldest son's. We value education in our family. And we made choices so that we could make sure that our younger son would have the attention that he needed, but not at the expense of our older son. So really the last 10 years have been about educating our children and getting them into the best position forward. The next 10 years will be about making sure that our older son does not have to be financially responsible for our younger son. And we put our older son through, he's a pretty gifted musician, and he plays the organ of all things, the pipe organ. And he went to boarding school for that. And we did not qualify for financial aid, but basically we're done. You know, we sent him to this boarding school, and out of the boarding school, he got an excellent scholarship. And when he's done with college, we will be done funding his life.
Oh, how nice.
We'll be finished.
That's sweet.
Well, it'll be, he understands what a big gift that is. But it has meant a lot of sacrifice for my husband and I, and has also mm-hmm. meant understanding how long I have to work and what do I have to bring home and how am I going to do that over the long haul. And there's been a lot of planning around that.
That's great that you did the planning.
Well, so, I got to execute the plan.
Kudos. Pardon me?
Execute the plan.
Well, there's that. Oh, yeah.
That's small detail.
But let me ask you a question about something you just said.
Sure.
You just mentioned about how important all of this planning is relative to your younger son.
Yes.
And even, as you mentioned, the end game for the business.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any plans to retire at some point, or do you never see yourself retiring?
I don't see myself not working either. I don't see myself not working for money for a long, long time. So I'm 52 now. My hope is that my plan is to be out of Double Forte in about by the end of 8 years, when I turn 60, that 60th year. And I have a succession plan in place in my company, and I have a couple options on that, right? And I have a few years to make, there's a few years to have things happen there. But I've put things in place to make that happen, and there'll be options. My goal is to have there be options, and for the business plan of the company, we're all about making those options possible so that when we get to that moment, in 6 years, 2 years before I'm out, that we have many different options we can think about executing. So right now, everything's about that. And that's what we're executing over there.
That's great.
The part of the book is actually, I'm writing a second book right now. And part of the exercise around writing the book and the work that I do around it, which is a lot of speaking, workshops. I get a lot of requests to come and help other companies figure this out, is that income will switch, that my income from my company will be equaled by the income from speaking eventually. It'll take a while. And then I cannot be so dependent on the Double Forte business as I leave it. And then I think I'm very involved with another reason I was very happy to start my own company was that I was going to have opportunity to be on boards and give back to the community that I have been so fortunate to be in. And I'm sure that work will continue in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I think so. It sounds very similar to your plan. Sounds very similar to what I'd like to do.
Uh-huh.
In the sense that I would like, having written the book, Power of the Purse,
mm-hmm.
I would really like to take that to another level with speaking.
Yep.
And have that become a major part of my life.
Yep.
And do all those kinds of things as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about something that you mentioned once before, in the millennial arena. You said that you also do a lot of speaking. Is that really what the topic is when you speak? Is it more about that, or how to develop PR for your firm?
No, actually.
What are the topics?
Yeah, the topics that people, well, I guess on the PR side, people always ask my opinion, right? The workshop stuff is usually around intergenerational work team. It's more about how to build a culture around positivity around that. And I do workshops, you know, they're everything's very factual based. I mean, because a lot of the sentiment, you know, it's sort of like hearsay, like those people are terrible. Well, when you break down the detail of why people think this way and what the facts say, so I spend a lot of time on the facts, like, well, this is why we're here. And then we do workshops on, or I lead workshops and speak, you know, speeches on what's one thing you could take away. Because I think, you know, every business book, if you could take one good thing away, that was worth the $24.95, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what I very much focus on. So that I work with each group before I go in to see what are the specific pain points. And then I focus on two or three actionable items that at least one will stick.
Tell me about this Everything Speaks desktop. I thought that was a very interesting concept,
yes,
that you sell that, because manners, as I understand it, are just, we kind of think, I think the baby boomers think that manners have gone the way of the horse and buggy.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I say, well, maybe not, because maybe there's a way that there are different manners.
Yeah.
So what is it that you came up with? Why this? I think it's great.
So it's called Everything Speaks, and it is a desktop guide. It's a card deck. It's over 150 cards in a box that sits on your desk about the manners that matter in the workplace. And the deck's divided by category. And so really it talks about the workplace etiquette that can get in your way, and no one would tell you. And particularly in today's environment, people might not tell you because they thought they could get sued by you because you were being judgmental or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, and I really created it for my own company. And here's something else I did for my own company that's now become a commercial product that we will start working on in earnest in 2017, pushing it out there. You can buy it today off my website if you wanted. But it really started in earnest because we used to recruit people. Part of our recruiting process was taking people to dinner because we do a lot of entertaining in our business, and you know, people watch us, and we work with different cultures. So, you know, being able to eat is actually important.
Yeah.
We did not hire two people just because they couldn't eat. And I think of myself like, that was so dumb. I could teach people to eat. I can't teach people to be curious. And once I sort of had that, you know, V8 moment, I decided that we would spend time in my company just talking about, here's how you eat, guys. Here's how you go out for dinner. I'm not going to assume that anyone has had the training that I did growing up, learning how to cut butter with the banana, because they come from all over the world. People come from all over the world with very different upbringings. I have people in my company who were the first people in their families to be in college, versus my family. You know, my mother was a Mayflower daughter, and my father grew up with a very, you know, very poor family in Iowa, and he put himself through Brown University and then Johns Hopkins Medical School, you know, and he was very curious. So I had a very different upbringing than most of my employees. Culturally, we have people from Asia, from South America, from the South, from the Northeast, from the West. I mean, so it's very different. So we put together, it started with just how to eat, and then it turned into, you know, how to, you know, think about how you put yourself to dress. And we, you know, like I said earlier, I give every informational interview that is asked of me, which I probably shouldn't say out loud, but oh well. And, but I am horrified by what walks through the door. I am horrified. And it is not their fault. No one has told them.
That's right.
And sometimes they don't know. Sometimes parents don't know because they haven't had white-collar jobs before. So they don't know what's appropriate. But, you know, if I have to tell one more woman to pull down her skirt and not wear the loose-side shoes, I just, you know, it's enough to make you slit your wrist. So I created Everything Speaks. With all these different categories, like how to email, how to do a proper email, how to use texting in your business and when not to use it, like take the damn Bluetooth thing out of your head when you're having a phone call, if you're in person, you know, all that kind of stuff.
And, oh my gosh. This is great visuals. I can see all these.
And in fact, so many of my friends, I was actually doing that before I wrote my book. So that was me a huge thrust of my other business, my side hustle, if you will. And then the book fell into my lap. So I haven't put the effort behind it that I had to put around my book. But I can tell you, many of my friends have bought these for their college graduates as graduation presents.
Wow,
because
that's a great idea.
When I went to college, you know, I went to this very liberal arts school, but we did learn these things. And again, I've had cotillion. And if you're not from the South, you are not, let me say it this way. If you're from the South, you are probably getting a lot more training around manners than any other place in this country.
I agree.
And it is a definite advantage for you. It is an advantage for you because you don't know what people are looking at. I mean, you don't know who's in the restaurant with you. You don't know who's in the elevator with you. You don't know who's on the plane with you. And, you know, something that's coming back is, you know, people actually dressing for a plane, like dressing for the plane ride, because you don't know who's on the plane with you. I've made deals on plane rides starting in LA and going to New York, or starting in San Francisco and going to Boston. And if you're just sitting around in your yoga pants, well, it's probably not going to happen unless you're sitting next to someone who owns a yoga company.
Okay.
Anyway, so that's
me. That's a great analogy. I love it.
My whole purpose in life, I feel like I'm here on this planet to help people achieve their goals. Mm-hmm. And my business is very well set up for my purpose, right? Because all we do is help companies achieve their goals. And these things that I've done that are, you know, my own business. So Lee Caraher, the brand, I guess, with my book and Everything Speaks. And my speaking is all about helping people just have the benefit of these currencies in their life. That's not just about money.
Let me ask you one final question.
Sure.
Would you do anything differently?
Oh my gosh. I don't have regrets. The reason I don't have regrets is because I've learned something all the time. I feel like from every situation, even if I was unhappy, I learned something super valuable that I have applied. Would I want to go through everything that I've been through in my career? No. No, thank you. I'm sure there's an easier way.
I'm sure we all feel that way. But as you said, you learn something from every experience.
I really don't want to be that person who is if I'd only, right? And you know, put up or shut up is my thing, right? And I have this saying, rocks are hard, water's wet. You know, it is what it is. You can move on, but you can whine once. That's it. And, you know, I try to live that way. Sometimes I have to go into my closet and whine a little bit to myself if it's not going the way I want it, because we all have bad days. But I don't want to have regrets over, I mean, as soon as I get to a place where, I shouldn't have done that, is when I have to change the dynamic. And sometimes that means getting rid of a person. And sometimes that means not putting my effort into this person. And sometimes that means, well, I guess I'm not going to hang around with those people, or, you know, whatever. But I think regret is indulgence.
I think regret's a waste of time.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing you can do about it.
There's nothing you can do about the past. Like, you can do something about your future. And so what can you learn to go forward? And my belief is the more we can help other people learn, help share our experiences so that they can learn from our experience, and not a don't do, no, not in a told you so kind of way, but in a sharing, and I guess the word is love, graceful way, joyful way, the better we can all be.
Wonderful. I love it. I love it. I love it. Lee, thanks so much. I really appreciate all the valuable insights and perspectives you just gave us. And I hope that my listeners will try to use some of this to help them move their career, their life, their relationships, and their financial freedom forward.
Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed your time with us on this episode of the Power of the Purse podcast. If you're ready to take action, go to womenofsubstancellc.com/call and sign up for an exclusive 15-minute one-on-one call with your host, Lynn Evans. Thanks again, and join us next time to explore more ways you can take control of your finances and your life.